I don't know about you, Mike, but I don't want to touch it because it's nice and shiny.
I think it's already past the point of no return for me.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know. I mean, I put new RAM in it and everything, and, you know, there's lots of holding on to it there.
Well, Mike, when's the first time you touched the keyboard?
Let's see. It was probably in first grade. We had Commodore 64s, and I was sort of – I don't think the teachers really knew how to, like, do anything with them. But that was back when everything came with programming manuals, and they were like, you look bored. Here, have this. Go do something instead of bugging us.
So you just jumped right into programming the Commodore 64?
Right.
From the manual?
Yeah, with BASIC. I mean, I wasn't doing anything, you know. It's like,
I wonder if you're a badass if you just look at the manual and you get going. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not like today, you know. Today you get a Mac Pro that costs $3,000 and has 2 teraflops in it, and the manual is like, here's how you turn it on. Have fun. But, you know, back in the day, it was like, okay, here's how to use this computer. And since nobody really makes software for it yet, you're going to have to build your own software. So we have to teach you how. And that was just, you know, that's just how they did things.
If I'm remembering correctly, my Apple II Plus manual was ring bound. So you could flip it over and, like, refer to it. Like, back when manuals actually used to mean something.
Yes.
Okay. Like, I don't know. Did you, so when you unpacked your Mac Pro, did you not find the manual for like 3 days?
No, I noticed it right away. I mean, that little black thing that has like 6 pages to it and is small enough to swallow is the manual.
Quote unquote,
right?
Manual. It's like stuffed into the top of the box, like into the flap.
Right.
And I unpacked it and I set it all up and I was kind of happy. And I was thinking, they really were kind of chintzy on the packing materials. Like, it's packed really nicely, but I'm like, there's nothing in it. And then somebody mentioned a black Apple sticker.
Oh, right.
And I'm like, what the hell? I didn't even get one. So I went back and sort of started looking at my box. I'm like, I was going to say they're too clever, but they're too clever for me, I guess.
Did you notice how the power cord was on the bottom, like acting as a cushion for it?
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
The whole thing was pretty well done and pretty cool. I was still a little.
The black RAM are like the coolest parts.
Yeah, that's a nice touch. But you upgraded your RAM.
Yes.
Did you buy special black RAM?
No, I just bought the green stuff from Crucial.
You didn't want to pay the Apple tax?
No, not especially. I got 32 gigabytes from Crucial for like $400, and Apple charges like $800 just for the upgrade.
Yeah, that's
so
crazy.
Yeah, they're doing their usual thing. It's nothing new.
Since it is the 30th anniversary, what do you think of the new Mac Pro? Do you think it's an interesting direction? Because it's a change. It's a change, right?
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, you know, if you think about it, the Mac Pros have been nice, but they haven't changed in ages, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
no, it's been a stock PC forever.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, that form factor was back to the G5. That's like, what, 10 years old or something? So.
Right. And if that form factor is really just like a nicer version of, you know, the PC AT sort of case, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's cool. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, sort of people worried about the lack of internal expansion and things like that. But I think Thunderbolt will handle it. You know, it's not going to take care of everybody's needs, but I think it'll be good enough there. You know, it's worth the trade-off, I think.
Yeah. And if not Thunderbolt, then clearly in the future.
Yes. Other things.
Thunderbolt 3 or 4 or whatever the hell, USB 8, whatever. It's going to get taken care of, right?
Right.
But yeah, so are you – how do you feel about the GPU heavy without being video game centric sort of capabilities of it?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's weird because it's not really for me. I don't really do a whole lot of that stuff. So I'm just sort of looking at it and thinking, gee, what can I actually do with this? I'm not sure. So
that's exactly how I was approaching it too. I'm like, this is an exciting thing.
Right.
And now I need an exciting idea. Yeah.
Right. But it seems very reasonable. You know, everything's headed slowly towards parallelism and crazy stuff like that. So might as well push it that way. And they must have got a great deal on those things.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, you know, why not include 2, right?
Did you get 6-core CPUs?
Yes.
Me too. I think 12-core is, well, A, performance-wise, it doesn't really make that much difference. But I think if you can parallelize something across 12 cores, you could probably do it on the GPUs better.
Yeah, that makes some sense. My main reason for stopping at 6 was just because everything else got very expensive.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know about you. Like, I can't really rationalize spending this much money on this.
Yeah.
Except it's like a new direction and I was excited about it. It's kind of a treat.
Right.
In a way, you know, like it's going to last me 5 years. So it's not like a totally frivolous thing. But, yep, you know, day to day, I don't need this kind of horsepower sitting here.
The one it replaced lasted 5 years. So,
right. Yeah.
What the heck?
So he started on the Commodore 64.
Yep.
Which had less power than one of those RAM chips that came.
Yes. way less.
What kind of stuff were you doing?
Like, you know, the dumbest, simplest imaginable stuff, you know, 10 print hello, 20 go to 10 kind of thing. I never really got beyond that on those things. Especially since we didn't have one at home. So, you know, right. It was just like occasionally screwing around. And, but I did end up doing BASIC on the Apple IIgs. We got one of those at home and, fairly similar.
I am so jealous because those machines, I really wanted one of those.
They were very nice. They were very cool.
They had color and they looked awesome. They looked in the future.
Right.
Yeah. They didn't have this mamby-pamby Mac stuff. For some reason, I was against the Mac. And
they did. When I was they did have all the Mac stuff, though. That was the thing. You know, it had all the same UI and everything.
Did it have the same UI? I thought it had a GUI, a graphical interface. But I thought it was kind of hacked and not that great.
It looked exactly like a Mac, except it was in color when the Mac didn't have color yet.
Oh, maybe that's why I liked it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just remember being excited about it. It went nowhere. It was a dead end product, but.
Yes. Yeah, yes. So. It was the last of the Apple IIs, except not because they discontinued it before they discontinued the 2E, which is hilarious.
Yeah. 2E was a workhorse. It was going way later than you think, like 88, 89 kind of thing.
I believe it was discontinued in 1993.
That is crazy. I guess it's just
I gotta look that up to make sure I'm not talking out of my butt here, but
no, that's what we do here. It's totally fine.
November 1993.
Wow.
So yeah, it was in production for over 10 years.
That's like Soviet era engineering where you just make something and it just lasts forever.
Well, as far as I understand, what basically happened was that they sold so many to schools and then the schools are like, we have all this software and we know how to use these things. So you keep selling them to us, please.
Yeah. We had a bunch of cloned Apple IIs at my high school.
Oh, yeah. Those are fun.
Yeah. Kind of flaky and fun. So what was programming on the 2GS like?
Well, I was still pretty bad at it. But, you know, I was doing BASIC there. And I got into a little bit of graphic stuff with that. Nothing much. But
what does the program structure look like? Does it have a run loop? Or can you still do the same printf or whatever, print hello?
I'm trying to remember exactly because, you know, for like basic text-based stuff, you'd basically do like, you know, print a prompt and then there was an input command that would grab a string from the user and you could do stuff with it, you know, so you could do sort of like interactive.
Yeah. And would it have a window or would it go full screen?
Oh, no, this is totally full screen. The UI stuff that I was telling you about was totally optional.
Okay, so, this is probably where I got confused with that.
Yeah, so you could boot. It was called GSOS, I think. And anyway, you could boot into that, and then you would have a graphical shell, and there were apps for it, and you know, you could do your word processing or whatever, and you had a Finder, and you had Windows, just like a Mac. But or you could not boot into that and have other stuff. And so the BASIC, it was the same BASIC that was built into the other Apple II. Right. So it was full screen, you know, 40-column, giant blocky text, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I still set up my terminal windows like that.
Yeah.
I use Amber because I had an Amber screen at the time.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's the way it's got to be.
All right. I actually use black on white. It's strangely modern of me.
Really? Just because you're sick of messing with defaults or what?
I don't know. I just like it. It's like printed text or something, except it's 9 points and blocky still. Yeah. But whatever.
So how'd you go out of the 2S? Like, did programming capture you? Like, was this your hobby as a kid?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. As I was, you know, starting out with the BASIC stuff, you could do some graphics with it. The low resolution mode was the only one that had like decent built-in support. So you'd issue a command that would dump the screen into a mode where there were four lines of text at the bottom, and then there was a 40 by 40 grid of pixels above it that you could control. So you could build really simple BASIC games with that.
Yeah, that's what I did. You did peek and poke, right, to get to set the pixels.
I think there were actually commands. I don't think you had to peek and poke for that mode. If you wanted higher res stuff, then you had to start doing that.
So you started making games.
Yeah, really simple stuff. You know, move this dot around, eat the other dots, whatever. And I remember there was one where I had it was like randomly generated music. You did have to peek and poke for that.
Yeah. But,
you know, it's like poke this particular location to generate a tone, depending on the value you give it or something like that. And I actually came up with like randomly generated music where I generate like 32 random notes and play them in a loop, and it sounded awful. And yeah. Good times.
Do you remember like Wolfenstein, the original one?
Yeah.
On those machines?
Yeah.
They did
really
primitive like voice stuff. Like it would yell Achtung at you.
Fine one.
In German by doing like peeks and pokes on it. On
right.
That, that was awesome. So when you graduated, did you go to a PC or did you go to a Mac first?
Still on the GS, I decided the basic was not good enough, and ended up learning Pascal on the 2GS.
Cool. Did you have a UI special work. Package for that? Like,
it was like a $200 compiler that you had to buy.
Oh, so you invested, like seriously.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And remember the – so it came with – there was a compiler, there was a manual. I think I got a tutorial. It might have been separately. I don't remember. But anyway, it worked through some very basic graphical programming stuff. And there was even an inside the Apple IIgs. It was just like inside Macintosh, except, you know, converted over. It had all the APIs and everything for you.
That's cool. Do you remember any of the, do you have a favorite project from those days?
The only one I can even remember building was I built a fake virus where you would just run the app and it would say, you have a virus.
I did that. I think everybody did that.
Probably. I think it was – I probably got the idea from somebody else who did it first.
I think I did one that made it look like I'd hacked into like Hydro-Quebec or something, like a power station. Like,
of course.
Just by writing – probably after I saw War Games.
Right. But it's kind of funny because I was so bad at this stuff for so long. Yeah. And it's like
people
always want to ask me, like, how did you learn all this stuff? How did you get so good and everything? And it's like, all right, well, first off, the secret is that I was a bad programmer for longer than you've been doing this stuff at all.
Right. Yeah. That's just good advice. I mean, that – no, but that should be encouraging to people, right?
Right.
Yeah. Don't worry
Persevere.
About it. Yeah. Keep at it and you'll be fine.
Yes.
So scholastically, did you – training sort of follow your interest here or what?
I mean, I was, you know, there was no opportunity for it at the moment because the 2GS was when I was still in grade school.
Right.
So, and then high school, I tried to take some programming stuff, but, you know, rural high school in the 90s, I knew more than they did.
Where'd you grow up, actually?
Originally in Virginia in the Shenandoah Valley, and then we moved to Wisconsin when I would have been around eighth grade or so. Okay. So right before high school.
So Silicon nowhere, basically.
Yes, definitely. We, you know, before the internet was really available to people, but we did bulletin boards and AOL and things like that. And in the Shenandoah Valley, we didn't live near any of this stuff. So, like, there were no bulletin boards or anything within a local calling area, which was
right. That's huge because, yeah, having local bulletin boards was a huge boon.
Yeah,
but it's a phone line, so you know.
Yep.
If it's not local, you're paying through the nose.
Exactly. So we actually figured out this really clever hack. Friend of mine, his father owned his own business and worked out of the house, and he had a separate business phone line. And it just so happened that he lived like in a zone that straddled our area and a slightly more populated area that actually had some BBSs.
Oh, cool. This can have two modems, right?
Well, no, actually we'd set up call forwarding.
Oh, so holy crap.
We could call him as a local call.
Yeah.
And he could call BBS as a local call. And his business line was free like nights and weekends. And so we paid him to set up call forwarding with the phone company. And basically what we do is like before I wanted to dial into AOL or a BBS or whatever, is I'd call the phone company special 800 number, whatever it was, and go through the automated prompts to change the call forwarding setup for his phone line.
Okay.
To point to whatever the destination was going to be. And then I pointed my modem at his phone line and it bounced through.
That's a nice trick.
That was fun. And then we had to be very careful to put it back before Monday came, right. Or else none of his clients could get in touch with him.
Everybody, yeah, they just get the modem handshaking.
Yes.
Not great for business.
No, not especially.
So where'd you go to university?
University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
And do they have any comp sci stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. They, it's pretty good there. Not real well known for it, but I thought I learned a lot anyway.
And that's the, you went straight into that. There was nothing else you felt like. Yeah. Like you were sold on this stuff, right?
Yeah. No, you know, a lot of people are like, I don't know what I want to major in. I was like, you know, when I was years out from graduating high school, I already knew. Yeah. So it was just obvious to me.
And so how was that? Because I didn't do, like you, I'm self-taught, but I didn't do any sort of formal training at the university level.
Right. Really. I gotcha. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was really good. It's such a personal thing. Some people learn great from that. Some people have trouble with it. I think it's pointless, whatever. And for me, it was good. I thought, you know, especially the more esoteric stuff, you know, I learned a lot of programming languages I wouldn't have looked into, on my own. The best course from all of it, I think, was the compiler's course. And I remember there was like some weird hole in the prerequisites. So I managed to get into that class when I was a sophomore.
Oh, come here.
And hadn't taken the upper level stuff they kind of assumed you would have taken. Mm-hmm. But it was great for me. I managed to keep up with it and learn a ton of stuff from that.
Yeah, I think compilers and operating systems are the two big ones that really sort of cement your understanding of how everything fits together. Right?
Yeah.
Or did you have a preferred language at this point or what?
We were doing everything in C++, I think. I don't know if I had a preferred language or not, but I guess that would have been it.
Yeah. Why? Just as a...
Just because it was what we were using for almost everything.
Yeah. So at the time you were... I mean, not even at the time. Are you more of a pragmatic language adopter? Because I know you're strongly opinionated about stuff.
Well, I hate pretty much all programming languages in one way or another. Yeah. You know, they're all awful in different ways. So, but yeah, you know, it's like I do most of my work in Objective-C these days. And why do I do that? Because it's the best choice for the particular jobs I need to get done, not because it's particularly great language. You know, it's an okay language. Wouldn't be my first choice if I could, like, rebuild the world around my desires, but...
What would it be? My gash. Just my gash language.
Yeah, sure. Probably look like Lisp.
Oh, really? So that kind of bends my mind. functional languages have a very different take on the world than...
Well, Lisp isn't really functional is the thing. You know, it's looked at that way, but Lisp is like... It's like a... Lisp is more of a language toolbox, really.
Okay.
Than a language by itself. You know, it's so flexible, and the macro system basically lets you build whatever you feel like.
See, that's the kind of thing that scares me. That's what
scares
me. But I mean, like, I'm not intimidated by it, but at the same time, I've seen enough crazy C++ template code that
So
when you can build your own custom language out of another language, that just means that every source base is like, I've got to start from scratch.
Yeah, so that's part of why it's probably not the best choice in the actual real world here, you know. And the other thing just comes down to you have to talk to C. And if you're going to talk to C, the best and easiest way to do that is to use C. So, you know, here we are.
Yeah, I mean, that's the baseline that runs everything, right?
So,
effectively. So how long were you – what's it, 4-year course?
Yeah.
Any – so – I remember when we first met, you were telling me about some high-end compute stuff you were doing. And I spoke to you about it recently, or I texted you about it recently. And I think maybe I got it wrong. But were you doing some nuclear, simulation
really.
Thing? Okay. I totally misunderstood.
I did this fluid simulation project for my master's degree.
Oh, that could be it. But you ran on the GPUs, right?
Because
you definitely had GL experience.
It was – basically, there were two parts to it. So I was doing the actual fluid simulation, but then I was also doing volumetric rendering for it. So you could render the fluid in 3D.
It could be that.
And both were parallelized. And both aspects were. So the rendering stuff, it could either output the results of the fluid simulation, or it could just output random, you know, 3D data sets that you felt like rendering. And some of those data sets that I got for playing around with came from the French Atomic Energy Agency. So I was curious as to what those exactly were, but I didn't know. And you know.
That's it. Because I think the first time we were talking about this, we were, we end up working at Rogue Amoeba together. We'll get there. But you did a, can we give away the fission Easter egg? I guess.
I think it's been it's
been enough years now. Yes. Yeah. It is.
And Rosebud was his sled, you know.
Yeah. The Fission Easter egg is it's Fission, right? It's like the it goes full screen and you do a bunch of OpenGL stuff to have a cool Fission simulation. So that was fun.
Yeah.
So was Rogue maybe your first job?
More or less, my first real job anyway. I was doing some of my own programming before that. I had a gig for a while as a contractor working on working with a company called Ultralingua, and they had a dictionary product of the same name that I was the principal Mac guy on for a few years.
How'd you like that?
It was cool. The code base was interesting when I took it over.
It was kind of old school, if I remember correctly.
No, it was just bad.
Oh.
Yeah. The guy who had written it before I got there basically didn't really understand Cocoa memory management.
Yeah.
And after a while, he basically just gave up on it. So I remember I was – when I first got
he would just retain everything all the time or that he would –
more or less, yeah. Just not pay attention to it and do whatever it took to make things work. So when I first got a hold of the code, I noticed – I was looking through. I was like, oh, wait a minute. This looks like a leak. And then I saw another one. Oh, this looks like a leak too. I wonder how much it's leaking. So I started it up. And, ran leaks on it, and it had a live search feature. So as you were typing, it would search whatever you had typed in at the time. It was really fast and cool and whatever. Mm. And every time you pressed a key, it leaked like 3,000 objects.
So it's fast for the first 20 minutes. And then after that, you're out of RAM at that point.
But fortunately, it was the kind of app where you would start it up and use it briefly. And, you wouldn't be like sitting in it continuously. So it kind of worked out. But, I made it my mission to fix all that stuff first.
And then so after that, you landed Rogamiba. You were employee number – you were the first outside hire that put you, number five or six?
Four. Yep.
I guess I'm number five.
There's the three founders first, and that was it.
Oh, yeah. Wait. Yeah, I thought they had somebody else. Oh, they had like –
Rudy Richter worked with them for a while, but he wasn't actually employed with them. They basically published for him.
Right. Okay. So I got confused by that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 004 at Rogamiba.
Right.
What year was that? Because I think I came in about a year after.
Let's see. Yeah. I started there right when I got my master's. I think that would have been 2005.
And so what was your experience with that? Because to me, it was new working from home. Rogamiba works entirely over IRC effectively. At the time, there was no real formalized, sort of issue tracking or anything.
Right.
And, it's been a lot of changes. It's been a long time. But was it a big shock for you, or had you been sort of accustomed to it with Ultralingua?
I think it was pretty much just the logical progression of things. I'd never really had a real office job or anything like that. So, I'd already been hanging out online with friends and whatever, and, communicating with the various little contract jobs I had and things like that. So it was more or less the same, just, more steady and, paycheck showed up every month, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Always a good sign.
Yes.
Yeah. It's funny because so for me it was a big change because I'd been doing video game stuff, which involved sitting in office for a long time.
Yeah,
with reasonably big teams and pretty big companies and all that. And when I interviewed with Rogamiba, the interview was on IRC, and I left my office job and I came home and I got on the IRC and I interviewed. I'm not sure if you were there. I mean, Quentin and Paul definitely were. Maybe you were in on that.
I don't remember honestly.
Yeah, I mean,
could be either way.
But I don't remember. I think it went well. But all I remember after is I quit my IRC client and I was like, oh, phew. Well, that seemed to go okay. And then, when you have an interview, well, maybe you don't, but a lot of people do. When you have an interview and you kind of go over it in your mind about like, was that good and what? And you sort of try to recall everything. I remember it just dawned on me then that I could have actually saved a transcript of my interview. So,
right.
but because I was so used to it being ephemeral or ethereal that I just forgot all about it. Oops.
We should go ask Paul. I bet he still has it.
Oh, God. That would be interesting.
Yes, I can hear the emphasis you put on interesting. It's like, yes, or I could go jump in a pit of live snakes.
Yeah, I honestly have no idea.
Could it be like those lost Star Wars audition tapes?
Yeah, exactly. So what, you know, recount the tales of what you worked on for Rogue Amoeba. What was the first thing you won? AHP, I guess, right?
Nicecast, actually.
Nicecast. Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. We did a contract to hire thing. Right. And I think they're still doing that whenever they bring new people on. You know, just make sure they work out well and everything.
Yep.
At the time they did 3 months with me before they hired me. And I spent a lot of that fixing up Nicecast to do something. And I can't remember what it was anymore. Very strange. But I do remember a lot of it had to do. Nicecast was basically a wrapper around Icecast, which is like a command line MP3 streamer thing. Yeah. And so Nicecast basically got the audio and encoded it and marshaled it and whatever, and then handed it off to an Icecast process, which ran in a separate process. So there was lots of crazy NS task things in there, and, you know, start it up and shut it down and see if there's any leftovers from the last time we ran and make sure it's properly dead and things like that. So
yeah. How would you pass the audio? Do you just make a pipe?
I think it actually listened on a socket. Like there was one socket for serving the audio, and then another one for receiving it from whatever master source.
Yeah. Nicecast is still used widely today. It's like if you're doing if we did this show live, we would be using Nicecast to stream it, basically, because it's like the most practical way of doing it on a Mac.
Yeah. So Nicecast is solid, but a little hard to use by itself, and so you put a nice UI on it.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Bob's your uncle. Yeah. Bob is not your uncle. It's just an expression.
I do actually have an Uncle Bob. So
really? It works. So then did you immediately go into fission?
Trying to remember. I don't think so. I think it probably would have been soon after that, but I don't know. The whole timeline's a little fuzzy in my head, but you know, I touched everything at some point or another. Did a lot of stuff on Airfoil, Fission, Audio Hijack Pro, whatnot. So.
Oh, Airfoil was, I think, the one you were working on when I came in.
Yeah.
Because you'd done a bunch of fancy ass math in order to to actually keep multiple speakers in sync, right?
In kind of sync, yeah.
So Airfoil is, for the listeners at home, Apple's AirPlay protocol, sort of adapted or repurposed, and it was the first one that could send to multiple clients and keep them in sync. At the time, AirPlay only did one client. Am I correct in remembering that?
Yes. I think technically, let's see, I'm trying to remember who came first. iTunes added the same capability at almost the exact same time that we shipped ours. And
it shipped around the same time.
I can't remember who was first. I think we came 2 days first.
Yeah,
I think we shipped on a Saturday and they shipped on a Monday or something like that.
Which kind of sucks. But I was there at the time. We didn't know that they were going to do that.
Right. But it occurs to me a lot of people might not understand the significance of this at all, because these days AirPlay works with, you know, everything. You can be sitting on your Mac and like, hey, play this game on those speakers over there, or, you know. Mm-hmm. iPhones will do it from whatever. But, you know, back in the day, it was only iTunes. And if you wanted any other audio on your Airport Express, you were just out of luck.
Yeah, and it was a huge deal trying to get it all set up, and especially the multiple sync. I mean, it took them years to do it, right?
Yeah, well, Apple did it the right way. They basically
– But they had access to everything.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The original protocol for AirPlay audio was not suited to sync at all. It was – you know, there was no fine control over when the audio came out. So if you're playing to one speaker, it's fine. Doesn't matter, really matter. But if you're playing to two, you couldn't really get them to both drive together. There'd always be some offset and you'd hear this horrible echo and whatever. And so Apple's approach was, well, this sucks. Let's design a new protocol that supports the stuff we need. And our approach was, well, we can't design a new protocol because we have to work with Apple's firmware. So let's bend the old protocol to our will. And, There was enough reporting back from the airports to where it would tell us, like, you know, we have this much audio sitting in the buffer. And I managed to write up a control algorithm where it would speed up or slow down the audio to make sure everybody was playing at about the same point. You know, if some guy got too full, he had too much audio, then we'd slow stuff down so he got less. for a little bit, and it was lots of fun.
Yeah, you're making that sound not easy, but still easier than it actually was.
Yeah, I guess the full story is that it took like 3 months to actually make it work. We had the idea for that as I described it, but going from the idea to something that actually worked took 3 months.
Yeah.
And we had all these ideas of, you know, the question is basically, how do you decide how much to slow things down and when?
Right.
And you've got this feedback loop going on, but it's very slow because you get these reports back from the other side, you know, once a second or so, and they're kind of delayed and whatever. So you could easily end up overshooting and coming back and overshooting again. And the user's sitting there with their audio going up and down and up and down. And they're like, what the hell's going on? And
right. You need some sort of very fancy averaging feedback loop.
Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up coming up with basically, I wrote the whole system down as differential equations and basically solved them. And amazingly, when I plugged that into the code, it like worked the first time. I was like, woo, this is amazing. Math is useful sometimes.
Are you serious? It actually just worked?
Yeah. Yeah. Once I came up with that algorithm, I just plugged it in because we had all the infrastructure there already. Basically, there was a bunch of code that was there. It was like, you know,
it could change,
speed
it
up
could
or
meter.
Slow down the audio. Yeah. Yeah. And it was just the part of the code where it was like, how much do we do it based on what the other end is reporting was in flux and didn't really work very well and whatever.
Well, that's
so
pretty impressive.
I plugged the math in and it worked.
Would you describe yourself as a math guy?
Not really. I mean, I guess maybe relative to the average programmer a little bit more, but
yeah,
not especially.
Did you take a lot of math in university?
Not a ton. Basically, you know, we had to take some calculus. And so 3 semesters of calculus. I did differential equations, the calculus-based physics, which is more math than physics, really.
Yeah.
But nothing, you know, super high-end.
You lost me at, like, addition, multiplication.
Yeah, well.
No, I mean, so my math knowledge extends into the sort of fields that I've had to actually use it for.
Right.
And a lot of it, to me, is still mostly opaque. Like, I do understand it, but, you know, like matrix multiplication, understand how that works, and I can do it, but most of the time it's just an opaque thing.
Follow the directions, like, right?
Right, yeah. Well, like, even like quaternion. I can make quaternions out of stuff. Right. I know how to interpolate them and I know how to turn them back. So
yeah, well, I think as far as matrices go and things like that, I'm about at the same level you are.
Okay. So. Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah.
Anyway,
pretty cool.
I gotta learn. I gotta learn myself. So how long were you at RA for?
6 years.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
How long was I there for? 4, I guess.
Something like that.
Can't remember. I got sort of drifted off when iOS came out.
Right.
So yeah, about 3 or 4 years.
Yes, we hated iPhone, so that was a bad fit for you at that point.
Yeah, I think that's yes. Yeah, it was kind of a bad fit. Plus, the funny thing is, I actually wanted to go ship my Mac app, which didn't ship for like so many years, just because the realities of actually,
yes,
you know, working and like having to do contract stuff just, you know, sucked up a bunch of time. But so you did Fission in that time.
Yes.
Which is a really interesting audio editing app in that it is lossless. It edits lossless files losslessly. Is that a good way of putting it?
Maybe that's confusing. No, that's a terrible way to put it, but okay. That's correct. Yeah, basically you can edit MP3s without re-encoding them, so you don't get any quality loss.
Yeah, that's better said.
Well, I did spend 9 months building it and then much more time after that updating it. So, you know.
Yeah, which is a remarkably interesting thing to be able to do because, I mean, and a lot of it's based on the way the MP3 encoding actually works.
Yeah, because they're not built to handle that kind of thing at all.
No.
You have to leave the data in the file. You can't decode it and then, you know, there's no way to like decode it and then re-encode it so you don't lose anything. You know, there's no like special trick there. You just have to leave it where you found it and sort of rearrange things just so.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, because any other way just reintroducing some compression artifacts. Like it just keeps doubling down on compression artifacts.
Right.
So that's pretty interesting. That's a fun project.
Yeah. I didn't really do any of the editing stuff directly. that wasn't my expertise there. So another guy at RA did that, Alex.
Yeah. Yeah, and the crazy Russian program.
Yes, the crazy Russian guy. And then I did basically all the UI and higher level editing stuff on top of his crazy libraries.
Yeah, which, you know, and it's a pretty cool app. Did you enjoy working on a Mac app?
Yeah, it was great. I'm always surprised by how it all turned out, because I basically, you know, it's a huge team effort and everything, but I more or less designed the UI for that app.
Right.
And, you know, the color scheme and the details and everything, I got a lot of help on that. But the very basic idea of how the UI was set up, was something I came up with. And I'm always amazed. People really love it. It won an Eddie for Macworld. And for a lot of people out there, they're like, yep, that's cool. But for me, it's especially amazing because I have no sense of UI or design or graphics or anything like that.
Well, I think the results, you know, yeah, would argue against.
Or so that. You thought.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was just a moment of inspiration. Yesterday I was looking at a tweet. I remember I happened to be looking at a tweet on the web, and I was like, there's something strange with this. There's like a bunch of extra spaces in here or whatever. And my, the designer that we have, Terry, she loaded it up and she's like, oh, you know, I think I ended up in like some weird A/B test with Twitter or something. And she sent me a screenshot of what she was seeing. I was like, okay, what's different? And she's like, okay, well, first of all, that giant bar at the top that's black on your screen is white on my screen, and the font is completely different. And like, oh, yes, I see now. But it's like totally
so not,
blind.
Not a subtle change. Not
yeah, no.
But no, it worked out okay.
Yeah.
Well, it worked out great, actually. Because, at the time, Rogue Amoeba hadn't hired a full-time designer.
Right.
Which they have no one, Krista Mergen.
Yeah, we got her after.
Yeah.
So we sort of muddled along for a long time, kind of. It's almost like design by committee, except like whenever you think of committee, it's like it's sort of the opposite of what we experience, you know.
Yeah.
Typically, like by committee, it's like, oh, we're doomed because everyone needs to get their input. But this is more like nobody quite thinks they know what they want or what they're doing, but they all sort of try. And, you know, it worked out okay.
Yeah. Well, it was the way that software used to work.
Yeah. You know? Things have changed.
And everybody was invested and cared a lot about the design. But I mean, you know, first runs of NetNewsWire and all that didn't have an official designer. It was just Brent doing it.
Right.
And similarly, you know, same thing with Voodoopad, which we'll get to in a bit, and Acorn. And, you know, that's the way these companies worked. And I guess maybe 2006, 2007, 2008, it started changing, where you really needed sort of a full-time graphical designer, or at least somebody with a bunch of design jobs.
Yeah, it was more or less concurrent with the iPhone, I think. I don't know if it was caused by it or what, but it was around that time when everything started.
Yeah, I mean, Delicious Library came out, and then there was a bunch of sort of overly ornate Mac apps.
Yeah.
Arguably overly ornate.
Yeah, people had to learn that, like, fancy design didn't mean just, like, going nuts with the gradients and lens flares. So.
Right. The one I did love was the CD burning one. That would
that had actual smoke.
Smoke. Yeah. Our friends did that, and our friend did the smoke, and that was fun. GPU accelerated smoke.
Sweet.
From a CD burning app. I forget the name of that one.
That's
it's Smegger.
That long ago. That was like what, seven years ago or so, and it's already like totally archaic. It's like, first of all, the design is ridiculous, but second of all, a CD burning app. I mean, that doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah. Whatever, made them some money, so.
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, things have always been changing, but it seems like it's going faster now.
That's interesting you say that. Faster than in the, you know, mid to late 2000s? Aughts, I guess?
Well, it's a continuation, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, this tiny little Mac Pro I have on my desk has no hard drive. It has no optical drive.
Yeah. Oh, in terms of that.
It's got no internal ports or anything. All, you know, all the storage stuff is just very.
Yeah, in terms of that, I thought you meant in terms of software design. Or at least interface design, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that has calmed down a bit at this point.
Yeah, I think we've kind of got a handle on that.
But the very idea that you could, like, make money by selling a CD burning app just sounds so strange now.
You know what?
It hasn't been that long.
you know what? Give it another 5 to 10 years and you'll be able to make a mint selling that. Because nobody else will be doing it. So if anybody needs one, build.
There you go.
You're the guy.
Yeah. Business plan.
Keep that in mind.
So what led to wanting to change up the game and get out of Rogue Amoeba?
I don't think there was any one specific thing. It was just sort of like, you know, wondering like what else is out there, you know, a little more variety, that kind of thing. So
it's kind of the same with me. I like doing iOS stuff, and iOS is not suited for the kind of stuff that Rogue Amoeba does.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's just a bummer. But
right.
For everybody, because I'm sure they'd love to do a lot more on iOS than they currently do. And, so you were just time to find a different pasture?
Kind of, yeah. I was just sort of poking around, like not real serious, but like, you know, I was get recruiter emails in my inbox every so often. Mm-hmm. And I was like, interesting idea, you know. And finally, Landon Fuller, who's a friend of mine and now my colleague at Plausible Labs, was like, you should come work with us. And the whole idea of working with a cooperative in that sort of environment seemed really interesting.
Yeah. So I love this idea. Yeah.
It's a really cool bunch of people, and I thought it would be a great move.
So explain the way the company works. It's a cooperative, right? Which means everybody is an equal partner, or at least
exactly.
partner of some kind. Is that unique to our industry? I'm not aware of any others.
There are a couple of others. I can't think of what they are offhand, but we're not quite alone. Every so often we get an email from somebody who's like, hey, this is really cool that we found you guys. We do this too.
That's cool. Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty unusual.
So what was that like, being approached to do that? Because it wasn't – this was not a job interview. This was do you want to be partners in this endeavor, which is a bit of a different thing, right? Because, I mean, there's a lot more – when you hire somebody, you can do, you know, the kind of the smart thing that maybe does, where they'll give you a contract for 3 months and see if they like you. It can't quite work this way, right? There's a lot more. You need to know if you can trust each other.
Yeah, yeah.
In different ways, you know what I mean? Yeah.
I'd known Landon for a long time at that point, so I think that was basically how it worked, you know. Although there is a bit of that sort of trial period thing anyway. For the first 6 months after someone comes on, they are not a full member, and it's essentially a probationary period.
Right. Yeah, just to see what's good for everybody. Yeah.
Right. And if the time comes and you're like, well, this person doesn't really seem to have it together, then you can part ways. And,
mm-hmm. and I'm going to imagine they can just walk too if they're not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So how many people are part of the co-op now?
We currently have 5, and then we have sort of an honorary 6th member who is a contractor living overseas because of immigration troubles. So it's pretty small. There were 3 of them when I joined on, so I made
them. So that's
4.
Your
– Yes. Yes.
Your modus operandi is
– Guess so.
Yeah. 004.
Yep.
So what do you work on? What did you work on when you joined up, I should say?
They were deep in the middle of working with Comixology on the comics app for iPad, and I basically just hopped right in and joined up and helped out with that at first.
And, if listeners don't know, that's the only game in town, effectively.
You basically just go to the App Store, search for comics. It should be the top. And
then Marvel and DC ones are effectively white label versions of the same thing, right?
So, exactly. And there's a bunch of other little smaller white labels too. So. Yeah, very, you know, they basically just like print money over there.
Yeah.
I don't know. They'd probably hate to hear that. They're like, we do actual work. This is hard, you know.
Well, it's the best way to read comics on the iPad, which is a big deal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, best way to read it, best way to get them, whatever.
Are you a comics reader?
No, actually, but doesn't mean I can't work on it. I mean, I never used any of Rogue Amoeba's apps aside from working on them. So, you know, you don't.
Yeah, I didn't really use them until I had to start recording podcast stuff. it turns out they're useful, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, there were times when I wanted to use them, but it's like every time I wanted to use them, I had to clean things up because my machine was always a mess, you know, and I had crazy preferences set up from trying to reproduce some guy's bug. And
I've had that so many times when it's like a piece of software that I'm working on, I'm like, oh man, I really want to use this. And it is just in pieces on the floor. It's like being a mechanic and I can never get to the shops because – you know, my car is in pieces. I just
exactly
get it walked the whole time.
Yeah.
So what you do in Comixology? Because that when you said you moved, I was kind of excited and happy for you in that it's a drastically different kind of thing, right? In one, it's like audio editing, and the other one, it's publishing. There's in-app purchasing stuff. There's a lot of graphics stuff going on. That's pretty cool. The UI is a lot more it's UIKit first of all, rather than being on the Mac. So it seemed like it seemed like you were really changing. You're like, I'm going to go to this now.
Well, there's a lot of interesting performance stuff to be done also, you wouldn't think of because, you know, comic reader, okay, you're showing an image and then you show another image, right? But the thing is that people have huge libraries out there. Mm-hmm. When we were in development on this stuff, I remember at one point they were like, okay, we need to go optimize the purchases screen. It's like, what do you mean? It's perfectly fast. And they're like, well, yes, unless you've purchased 10,000 comics. And... Mm-hmm. You know, there are
an awful lot of Spider-Man.
Yeah, there are real customers out there who have that many purchases. And obviously you kind of want to keep those people happy because they give you a lot of cash. So, you know, go make this faster.
Yeah. So was that kind of your thing? Were you like the low level, go fix it?
Yeah, that's generally what I do in general is, you know, whatever stuff people are like, oh God, this looks hard. I'm like, sure, I'll try, you know, make things faster, do weird networking stuff, multi-threading, whatever. That's my,
multi-threading is your,
that's my thing.
Yeah. That is, it's like Dragon Slayer territory, man. Multi-threading sucks. but Plausible Labs in general, I have a very high opinion of them because you publish a bunch of, source code to do error reporting. Everybody there seems to know their stuff inside and out at from a very low level up. Like they seem, it's Plausible Labs seems like a good spot for you to land. Would you agree with that as an analysis? Like, I don't know if people realize just how many low level brainiacs.
Labs. Yeah. Landon is pretty much, you know, my double as far as that goes. So, he's done most of the work on the crash reporter.
Yeah.
Which is all very low level, difficult, crazy stuff.
Yeah, you're like unwinding the stack and doing all that stuff. Like
you do a lot of
symbols.
Right, you do a lot of stuff that sounds really hard, like unwinding the stack and looking up symbols, and you know, recording register states and pausing and inspecting other threads and things like that. Which is bad enough as it is, but then you're doing it from within a crashed process where you can't let anything run anymore and you can't call any APIs whatsoever.
Right.
That's in any circumstances. Yeah.
Right. Try doing a linked list of like stacks when you can't get malloc. You know, you're kind of in a bad spot at that point.
I actually managed to write a hash table in there.
I am not surprised you did.
But it was kind of a cheap hash table. I was doing some stuff. When you look up symbols at runtime, you know, a lot of times the symbols are missing.
Yeah.
And I wrote some code to do a backup symbol lookup where it would also try the Objective-C runtime metadata. Mm. And essentially, if this address doesn't have a debug symbol, but it turns out to be the implementation for a particular method, then you can get the name for it by looking at the method info.
That's awesome.
If it's called description, then, you know, there you go.
So if you fail to get the thing, like the imp is a pointer.
Right.
And then you just run through the entire Objective-C runtime comparing against the pointer. And if you can find it, then you've got the Objective-C information, including, I imagine, the method signature.
Yeah, I don't think the method signature is all that useful, but we can get the class name and the method name, which, you know.
But wait, from the method signature, you could figure out which registers account and which, like –
what's
on the stack, like you know, when they
leave that stuff up to the person who receives the report. You know, we'll give you the registers, you figure out what they mean. Although I think we're kind of moving in the direction of doing more analysis like that slowly once we kind of figure out what people want.
Well, to me, I think that would be a weird and hard thing to ship, but fun to do in the labs.
So there's a code path where it was basically doing a lookup and it had to do some sort of very slow linear search or something like that. And it's like, well, I need to speed this up. So I wrote a cache using a hash table. And because it was just a cache, I could be very stupid with it. And if there's a collision, then, you know, just ignore one of the values and you don't make it in the cache, whatever. So that made life easier.
That's pretty cool. Also, don't need to allocate any memory.
Yeah, well, I allocate it, a fixed amount of memory. So.
Oh, you did static, like as
not
in
a static. I used the mock calls because the mock calls are still safe to call, like from any state. So even though the process is crashed and paused and whatever, you can still use mock calls to allocate like pages at a time.
Right.
So I just allocate a page for my cache and use that.
Yeah, that's this is actually probably the most low level we've gone on this show, but let's go with it. Malloc is a pretty high level call to be making.
Which is in the shocking to some people, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's kind of why
like super high level. It's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, I mean the amount of work that goes behind. Like, if you could malloc 4 bytes. Guess what? That doesn't come for free. Like, the actual atomic allocation zones are 4K. Well, the page size of whatever the processor is. So there's a lot of work that goes to make stuff like malloc and calloc and all that kind of work for you.
Yeah, basically.
So when you do like OS. New something, you're so much way up the stack, it doesn't even matter.
Yeah. The hardware and the OS work with memory in chunks of 4K. And anything smaller than that is like whatever. We don't care. Yeah. You deal with it. So much fun there.
I guess that's true and I think we're likely to see these days, because I think that 4K, while in theory the page size is variable, we're not gonna see different page sizes. We're not going to see an 8K page size.
Right. I don't remember the details, but I seem to recall that modern CPUs are starting to get support for large pages, like a megabyte in size or so. But that's all basically transparently managed by the OS.
Okay.
If the OS notices, like, hey, looks like you have a megabyte of continuous RAM here, I'll take advantage of that to make the page table cleaner. But you never see it. You know, if you do something that splits it up, it handles it.
I'd like to see sort of dictionary style hash table style lookups on the chip, where it's kind of like a page fault, except it can redirect, so it can like reorganize memory.
Well, it's kind of how the MMU works already.
A little bit. That's why it's not super far fetched, right? But if you can consolidate a bunch of memory onto say half of your RAM, you can turn the other half off.
Right, I see.
Save a bunch of Anyway. Now we're definitely down a rabbit hole. So we started with basic, like 10 print, hello, 20,
yep.
Go to 10. And now we're a little bit down a rabbit hole.
Story of my life right there.
So one thing I've always loved, when I started my bloggity blog, I started doing stupid Cocoa tricks, like just dumb stuff that you could do with the Objective-C runtime, because it was fun.
Yeah.
And, I like to chat about, like to chat to you about that kind of stuff when we were at RA. And just in general, I don't bother doing that anymore, because your Friday Q&A is so much better and smarter and just a more well-structured inspection and learning experience about the way all of this kind of stuff fits together. Did you intend that, or were you just – because
No.
It's a teaching tool. It really is. And I think you kind of started the same way, just being like, hey, look how crazy this is.
Well, I tried that. That's like the whole reason behind the name of it. You know, the blog itself is called NS Blog, which is super creative, whatever. but everybody knows it as Friday Q&A. And the way that came out was I started out like, here's this stupid fun thing I came up with. I'll write it up for you. Right. But it's hard to come up with stuff like that. Like, do people even care about this? And what am I going to write about? And
That's why I wrote one every 6 months. And
right.
You've got to feel pretty okay with it being stupid and something you can share with people.
Right.
Because otherwise it's like, hey, this is stupid. Now everybody's using it and you feel like a jackass.
Yeah. And so one day I was like, all right, I got some readers, but I don't know what to write about. And maybe I could just solve this problem by seeing if they have any ideas. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to make this a weekly thing. You tell me what you want to see and I'll do it. And that's basically how it's been ever since. So that helps a lot, because, I know someone is interested in this because they suggested it to me, and it gives me a lot of ideas I wouldn't have come up with by myself.
Right. But you implement a lot of sort of pretty basic, not, I don't want to say basic, but things that people take for granted when dealing with Objective-C and, the Cocoa frameworks. I think recently you did NS Object.
Yeah.
Which I found interesting. And it's just a, did you get a lot of feedback on that? Or like, it's just such an interesting thing to sit down and do and say, hey, look, I know you use NS Object all the time. Here's how it actually works. Or here's an implementation that could work based on the interface.
Right, right. I mean, it's kind of a technique I use just when working, coding by myself, whatever is, anytime something's sort of mysterious and like, I don't know what's going on or I don't know what this would do or whatever, I kind of sit down and think like, okay, if I were building this, what would I do? Mm-hmm. And even if it's not the exact same thing, it's usually close enough to kind of tell you what's going on.
Yep.
And, you know, so NS array has pathological behavior here or NS object does something strange over there. And, you know, if you just kind of sit down and reason it out as far as like, how would I build this? A lot of times it just becomes clear. That's much the basis of those articles.
Have you done NS array?
Yeah. Yeah, I did NS array and NS dictionary both.
Did you have similar? I'm trying to remember, and I'm scanning down your page way too quickly. So you could wait. There's way too much good content here. I can't find it.
Use the tags browser.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good idea. Did you have similarly odd or seemingly odd times when implementing NS array? In that, like, an insert in NS array is not always a one. And like an O1 sort of operation, right?
Yeah. Well, there are limits to how accurate I try to get for NS array and stuff like that. It's basically just the simplest possible re-implementation of the official API.
Right.
So my array is just a plain linear chunk of memory, and when you insert something at the beginning, everything else gets moved down.
Right. Okay, that's cool.
No fancy tricks like Apple gets up to.
Yeah, because they get oddly fancy. Not oddly, but. I guess appropriately fancy when right. What you're doing sits at the basis of a whole bunch of other stuff. Do you have a favorite?
I think Let's Build Objective-C Message Send is probably my favorite there.
Yeah.
I got to write a bunch of assembly code and other interesting stuff there. So it's always fun.
And I'm going to guess you link to the I'm scanning it now. This is intriguing radio. I'm scanning this low level stuff. I think BBOM had a bunch of interesting stuff on Objective-C methods send at one point.
Yeah, there was basically just like a walkthrough of exactly what every little piece did.
Yeah, which I found.
A guided tour of the assembly code. And yeah, that's really cool stuff. So I kind of approached it from the opposite end.
Right.
Like, you know, he did like, what do we have and how does it work? And I did more like, you know, how would we make this from scratch if we didn't have it already?
So I think anybody who's interested in – well, you know what? Anybody that bothers showing up and programming for the Mac or iOS should go read this. Once you understand –
Don't let the assembly language scare you away. No. I see this a lot because people are like, oh, well, yeah, you know, that sounds cool, but all that assembly is like, ah. But, you know, it's not that hard. People get scared away from it, but it's just – it just takes a little bit of effort, but it's not really mentally taxing.
Yeah. No, I was going to go there. In that earlier in the show, we were talking about peaks and pokes. You know, it's effectively assembly.
Right.
I was doing assembly as a teenager, like writing graphic stuff. I was doing compiled sprites. I am not all that smart a guy. I'm just stubborn enough to stick with this kind of stuff. Assembly is easier to understand than a lot of high-level languages and certainly frameworks. In the
individual pieces, definitely.
Yes.
The trick is always putting it together.
Yes. Yes. But I could give you a list of instructions and you'd probably be able to figure out what's going on. Like load this into that, load that into this, add the two together and like store that into something else. Like you can, it's a recipe. Like it's
right.
You're telling a very, well, on the surface, a stupid piece of machinery what to do. Right. And it's very atomic instructions. Like literally they're atomic instructions. So.
Yeah, the trick is not, you know, what does this do, but why is it doing it?
That's really. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Don't be scared.
And then that's why I walk you through it. So
yes, exactly. And I think as soon as you understand Objective-C message send and the way that sort of the runtime works, you're pretty good to go on a lot of really high level features. You can understand how KVO can work, once you understand how Objective-C message sounds.
Yeah, it's the basis of, you know, everything, basically, in Objective-C land.
Yeah, key-value coding, like, you name it, it works. Properties, like, whatever. It's definitely worth... I mean, this article is going to take you 20 minutes to read and probably an hour and a half to fully understand, but it'll save you time, energy, and happiness down the road. So, yeah, definitely do that. One thing I do want to talk to you about is Gus Mueller sold VoodooPad to Plausible Labs.
Yes.
And he specifically called, and like, I hate Gus for this. In his notice, he's like, well, Mike Ash is the one guy that I'd let work on this code. And I'm like, hey, you know me, you jerk. But it's true. I would also rather have you work on this code than I would. How did that come about?
He had just sort of like asked me out of the blue and was like, hey, would you be interested in taking this over? Whatever. He's Acorn is turning out to be his cash cow and his real, his big product. And
it's also spending very close to his heart. Like he's invested in the graphics side of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great product. It sells well. He enjoys it. His users enjoy it. You know, it's win-win all around. Yeah. But it's been taking up more and more of his time, and he's been spending less and less time on VoodooPad as a consequence. And finally, he's like, I just don't think that I can keep it up. You know, it takes effort to maintain it or whatever, and it might be time to hand it off to somebody. So he just came to me and was like, would you be interested? And at first it was like, would you be interested in taking this over? Like, you know, as a side project, whatever, you know, hand it over to you and you do it on nights and weekends and things like that. I was like, well, you know, yes, but first let me just pass it around to the guys at Plausible because why not? And I figured there was like no chance that anyone would go for it. But it's like, I might as well ask.
Yeah. Why do you think that? Just because it's the company isn't necessarily product oriented?
That, and also just like, I don't think anyone else had heard about the app besides me. And it was sort of like, you know, hey guys, let's spend a bunch of money and get this thing that I'm a really big fan of personally. Right. And you guys have no idea exists.
Yeah.
And won't that be great? So, you know, I was kind of anticipating what is this? No, I don't think so. Right. Sort of reaction. But they were basically like, yeah, this is actually really cool. I like this app a lot. Let's go for it. And so now I'm actually doing that full time at the moment.
So you're the VoodooPad guy at Plus.
Yes. Yes. You know, we're, as usual, we sort of switch off and different people are doing different things. So, but
I think that's super healthy.
Right at the moment.
I think you need to move around or else you get kind of, you know, you start feeling like you're stuck in a rut a little bit.
Right. Well, the VoodooPad code base is sort of like an object lesson in that, you know, with all props to Gus on building a great product, you can definitely tell in certain areas that it was one guy for 10 years.
Right.
You know, a lot of the comments are just like curse words. And
I've seen Acorn. So, just as an aside, that is, I'm sure everybody or many of our listeners are developers. Code ends up sucking after 10 years. Doesn't matter who does it, but it becomes like a hermit's nest at times. You know, like different segmented areas and all that.
And really, the code base, I think it's remarkably good overall. Yeah. It's in great shape for the most part. You know, there are little details, like a lot of the comments have curse words, and you know, some of the variable names have little cutesy names like Lublock and things like that.
Yes,
but those are pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. You know, there's nothing that makes me just like scream in terror.
I worked on a game years ago, and he's a good friend of mine, Jimmy, if you're listening, hey. he didn't want to use the word flag in his code. Like, it literally was a pathfinding thing, and he just had a flag, and he just wanted to call it flag. But so he wrote drapeau, which is flag in French. Just because, so, you know, he felt better about it.
In the context of games, I'm a little confused. Are you talking about like a bit, or are you talking about like an actual flag on the game somewhere?
Oh, no. This was it was a bool value.
Okay.
I can't remember if it was a bit or not, but it was basically like, has this, in this A-star implementation, has this thing been visited or not? But it wasn't as simple as visited. It was like some other state that sort of defied description based on other stuff. So anyway, drapeau it is, you know?
Yep.
So, How are you enjoying it? Because you're back on the Mac doing Mac products.
Yeah, well, it's a bit half and half too, because there is an iOS version of VoodooPad as well, which is a bit behind the Mac, and so we're actually trying to bring it up to par as one of our first things.
You know, so that's a huge task because, I don't know if it's huge, but I don't believe VoodooPad on iOS has rich text support yet.
Yes, it does not. And we are deep in the middle of that right now.
Yeah. And because VoodooPad on the Mac has for a long time been a really great citizen in that it leveraged sort of the RTFD format and did interesting things with it.
Right.
Which is what I think enabled like a one guy show like Gus to get VoodooPad out, you know, 10 years ago, like whenever it was, 2001, whenever he shipped it. So that's got to be an interesting rehaul for the iOS code base.
Yeah, well, we're kind of finding out like just how much nice stuff Apple gives you on the Mac too, because you know with iOS 7, there's some basic support for rich text built in at this point. You can read RTFD data and get it into a text view and whatever without a lot of work, but it's still missing a lot of pieces. One of the things we've been struggling with are lists. Which on the Mac, you've got a built-in UI for creating lists and the editor handles it for you. You know, when you press return, it's like, oh, you're in the middle of the list. I'll insert a new entry. And all that stuff we have to re-implement ourselves on iOS still.
Yeah. And as text view is remarkably smart.
Yeah.
Given that it's been around forever. But,
yes. There's some kind of annoying aspects too, because lists again. On the Mac, you've got NS paragraph style, which then embeds an NS text list, and that's how lists work on the Mac. And on iOS, it's the exact same thing, except NS text list is a private class, so we don't get to use it. And it's like, why? Oh no.
Well, so, I guess painful. I don't know. They'll open it up, maybe. I mean, because that was a reasonably late addition to the Mac,
2000. I think it was 10.4. Yeah.
We'll go with it since we both guessed the same number. But yeah, so that, yeah, I don't know. That's weird that maybe they want to have a UI before they expose it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to tell. You would think like, you know, here's this API that's been stable, pulled over from the Mac and, you know, open it up. But
yeah,
who knows?
Well, they don't have ruler views or anything either, right?
Right.
So there's a bunch of crap in – not crap. There's a bunch of really great stuff on OS X that has to do with editing text. It's just kind of taken for granted.
Yeah, and NS Text View is basically just like a text editor right there.
You just drop
and
it.
UI Text View is not quite it.
Right.
It can serve as the basis of something, and that's what we're doing, and we're getting there. But it's more
okay, so that's good because I was going to say, are you going to leverage the UI Text Kit stuff as much as you can? Or are you just going to be like dropping to Cortex? Because
we are currently using UI Text View and it's working out pretty well.
Yeah.
So Gus actually did a bunch of work on this beforehand, and we're mm-hmm. picking up where he left off. And so yeah, we take the RTFD data and load it into UI Text View, and it takes care of parsing and rendering and all that stuff pretty well for us. So basically, we're just having to do some UI work, like so that you can pick fonts and colors and things like that.
Right.
And of some kind of helper work like the list editing stuff, but a lot of it's there, and I don't see any reason why we would need to drop down as long as we don't hit any show stopping bugs, which you can never quite tell.
Yeah,
well, but so far so good.
That's great. I'm really not trying to hold you down, but do you have a vague timeline for that? Like maybe iOS 8 is enough for you to ship, depending on the amount of work, you know.
I am really hoping that we can start getting it out to testers in the next couple of weeks.
Wow. Okay. So you're really close. Yeah.
Yes. So no promises. That's not official. Blah blah blah. But you know, I'm hoping like worst case we'll get this version shipped in a month or two.
Wow. Great. Okay.
Really, really hoping. Would very much like to do that.
Well, I'll hit you up so you can put me on the list.
Right.
Because I'd love to try it out. So in terms of the Mac aspect of it. You excited to get back to the Mac? I really like working on the Mac. I know it's old, and I know people bitch about AppKit, but it's like, I don't know. The Mac just – it feels like home to me.
Yeah.
I like the exciting stuff of iOS, but it means the Mac is just – it's where
I live. Yeah, right? It's much nicer, really, I think. You know, less hassle to deal with. You have decent amounts of RAM, and you know, you can like have sub-processes and things like that. And
yeah.
It's just – it's much friendlier to be with.
So are you doing much VoodooPad work on the Mac these days? Or like, do you have to adapt the Mac stuff to suit the iOS stuff?
We're trying not to do that. I think we're going to succeed because it would be really nice if the new iOS version continued to work with the current version of VoodooPad Mac. And it looks like that shouldn't be a problem.
So it doesn't look like you're going to get sort of trapped into doing like an iWork 2013.
Right, right. No, I don't think so. The file format is really good. I think Gus did a great job with that. It's very flexible and easy to work with, and there's nothing really constraining about it.
Mm-hmm. It's like a bunch of FMDB with some RTFT stuff inside a package?
Well, actually, the basic file format is essentially every page has a plist, which describes the metadata.
Oh.
And along with the metadata the metadata includes like a type, which the type will be like, you know, this is plain text, this is RTFD, this is a JPEG, whatever. And then next to the plist is just a file which contains that data in whatever format's been specified.
Oh, that is so simple. It's awesome.
Yep. So if it's an RTFD, then, you know, the file that contains the page data contains RTFD data, and that's it. And then that's a little slow to parse and whatever. You're trying to find a page. It's like, where is it? I don't know. So then there is some database stuff using SQLite and FMDB where it's not canonical. So it's essentially a cache where it parses all the page plists and puts them into the database so that when you're looking for stuff, you can do it faster.
It's like the inverse of iTunes.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. All right. So you got this very simple, flexible format that's like the master repository of everything. And then you got some cache stuff that makes it go fast.
It's really cool.
Yeah, so it's very flexible, hasn't caused any trouble, should be extensible and serve us well.
Yeah, well, I'm super happy that it landed with you guys because, I can't think of anybody better to do a good job with it. You're a regular user, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been using it for basically since it shipped originally back in 2004 or something.
Great piece of software. I was going to ask if there's anything you want to plug, but I think everybody should just go out and buy VoodooPad.
All right. That's a good start. And then also check out PL Crash Reporter and Hockey App because we are involved with the Hockey App guys.
I didn't know that. Yes. Oh, I use that regularly. That's a good app.
Good. Yeah. We have a partnership with them. And so we're actually working on some of their stuff and we're doing some PL Crash Reporter work, which is all open source, but, basically for stuff that they need, but everybody else gets the benefit of it too. And we actually have the PL Crash Reporter Consortium, which if anybody out there works for a company that uses PL Crash Reporter extensively, you can join up and get support and input on where we take it and everything. And
didn't Hockey just add crash reporting to the Mac?
Fairly recently, I think. I don't
know. Is it based on all your stuff underneath?
Yes.
That is funny because I think we just integrated into our Mac app, Napkin. I'm a fan. I mean, we've never had a crash, so we wouldn't know.
But. You might want to check and make sure your crash reporter is actually functioning.
Yeah. Maybe.
When you turn it on, the stats change.
Right.
Exactly.
We put it in the iMore app, and I think I have 800 apps in Hockey now. It's fantastic.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, we work closely with those guys, and they do great stuff. But we've got in the consortium right now, Criticism just joined up. We've got Hockey, Flurry is also joined, and we're hoping we can get some more guys in because PL Crash Reporter kind of forms the foundation of a bunch of these analytics reporting frameworks.
I was not aware of that. I was intimately aware of Crash Reporter because I check it out pretty regularly. As sort of an academic exercise, just because it's cool to figure out, you know. I didn't know that it was building such a wide audience across it. That's great.
You're using it against your will, right?
Well, now I'm using it.
They're in all your stuff, guy.
Right. Now you know.
Yeah. I'll up in my,
jammy.
My peanut, exactly. cool, man. Anything you want to add?
I don't think so. But it's been fun.
It has been fun. Yeah. We got to get you back for every now and then we do like a panel discussion.
Aha. Okay.
And I'd like to have your input on, I can't even think of one.
All of them. Just...
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, but I don't know. If we ever bitch about language features or something.
Right.
Let's get Mike in here. Multi-threading would be fun. Well, honestly, we're what, like a minute, 50, an hour 15 right now?
I just like how he can explain how 64-bit works even to a bunch of dumb bloggers. That was the most useful post of last year.
Yeah, okay. Okay, you know what? Screw it. Let's double down on this. The 64-bit transition was awesome because it was wildly misunderstood. Apple, I don't think, helped in the initial presentation in that they claimed that the chip was twice as fast.
Yeah.
But it also doubled from 32 to 64.
Right.
Ergo, the only possible reason is the doubling of this, which was not the case, right? You wrote up – it wasn't scathing because I don't think you pointed anybody out. Did you?
Actually, I did.
You did.
At the beginning, there have been a lot of misconceptions floating around, and like every single word, I linked to a different article that got it wrong.
So I made sure I asked Guy before I published.
Did you get it right?
No, I made sure. I had the good fortune of seeing you like right when it happened, and I just that was the first question I asked. What does it mean? And you were nice enough to tell me.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that discussion, but that's good. Do you get a lot of pushback on that? How did that go?
Not much. I don't think most of the people I linked like that really cared. One guy did write back, and he was like, you know, gee, thanks for pointing all this out, but I really wish you would have told me what was wrong with my article before you called it out in public and whatever. And
so how I feel is I publish it in public, so it's fair for you to correct it in public.
That's what I thought anyway, but I kind of did him like a backhanded favor there. I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, since you've been so nice to me, I will do you the favor of correcting the errors in your article now. And it was basically like, you know, every paragraph was wrong.
Yeah.
And I just went down his article like one by one and was like, okay, you got this wrong, you got this wrong, you got this wrong, you got this wrong. And he was like, oh, thanks. And then nothing ever happened again.
You showed me that. And I loved it. It was great. Very cathartic.
And then one guy was very upset with me because John Gruber linked to me and he
– Oh, maybe this is the one you showed me.
He thought I was indirectly being a marketing shill for Apple and Gruber and – like, you know, he's like, okay, it matters, but Apple's overstating it and you're not helping the case and whatever. And it's like, yeah, go away.
Yeah.
You're dumb.
Yeah. That is the guy clearly does not know you.
Basically, he was upset.
Speak your mind and you come from a position of authority and that you don't just make shit up. You actually know what you're talking about.
He was upset that Apple was giving it a marketing push, and essentially he thought that should be countered, and he thought that my completely apolitical, dry technical discussion of the merits didn't have enough like counterbalanced negativity.
Well, if I remember correctly, he complained that it was too technical.
Yes. I think that was that guy. Yes.
Yeah.
So that was pretty funny. it was too technical and didn't explain how Apple was wrong.
Yeah, it's not your job. It's your job to explain the technology behind – or it's the job you chose to take. So in the future, kids, don't mess with tech before you check in with Mike because he'll take you down.
And if you're writing an article about a technology you don't understand, my services are available for very reasonable rates.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Hire Mike to yell at you in private before he yells at you in public because, you know.
There you go.
It's kind of like, hey, nice article you get there. Wouldn't want anything to happen to it.
Well, I mean, like everybody screws up. So the important thing is how you handle the screw up. Yeah. And if you learn from it, then it's a beneficial screw up.
Yes. Although I think there's different kinds of screw ups too. You know, if it's like, well, I just got this wrong because of whatever, then it's okay. But if you like write an entire article that's just filled with nonsense and you write it all from an extreme position of authority, like I definitely know what I'm talking about and here's what's going on. Right. Yeah, that's sort of like a different category.
Yeah, that really rubs – well, it rubs me the wrong way, but you just do not put up with that shame. In a good way. I mean that affectionately. Right.
You can pour iOS 7 into your coffee and make it sweeter.
That's right.
Three pages later.
Yes. iOS 7 makes your phone waterproof.
I got sent that maybe 300 times that week.
Wait, What? Really?
Yeah.
This was an actual rumor that was going around when iOS 7 came out.
Seriously? It was a 4chan thing. So I think it started in 4chan and then people ran with it and people were actually throwing their phones into water and ruining them.
Oh, I was a richer person before I knew that. That is what a horrible world. That's really sad.
Yep.
What a bummer. I was talking to a buddy the other day and he was explaining the operating system versions on PlayStation and the Xbox, but he's not a technical guy. And he just kept referring to them as the iOS on the PlayStation 4 and the iOS on the Xbox One. And I just had to, like, I just bit my tongue. I'm like, he's just using a word. It's fine.
So close.
Yeah. Close enough. It's just that like lowercase I stuck in front of it.
He's going to go to the iPad store and buy one, guy.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to be positive. It's like, well, Apple has really made this a thing, I guess. But yeah. Closing out like we started, 30th anniversary of the Mac. Do you have any, like, you don't often progress,
prognosticate.
Thank you.
There you go.
In terms of technical stuff.
Now, when you edit that, you're just going to take that perfectly pronounced version that you said and insert it into Guy's speech, right?
Oh, yeah, hell no.
Part of my charm is just screwing up all the time.
Prognostication.
You don't do that often.
I sort of did that on my blog a little bit at first when I was like, I don't know what to write about. But after a while, I was just like, you know what? This is dumb. I don't actually know anything about, you know, like the non-technical aspects of this stuff, and it's not that interesting. And other people do that better, so I'll just let them handle it.
So in terms of the technical, because I'm going to hold your feet to the fire.
All right.
In terms of technological features or features that you would like to see, do you have any in mind that would make your job easier or just make computing more interesting for you in general?
I don't know. I mean, the Mac side is – it's like it's complete almost. It's like there's very little that I can think of where it's like, oh, man, this is really – screwing me up by not having this.
You want to say just say file system so Syracuse it doesn't.
Yeah, there are a lot of things like that where it's like incremental fixes, which I don't know. For some people, I imagine the file system is not an incremental fix, but you know, right. From where I'm sitting, it's like, all right, things would be mostly the same, but better. Right. So yeah, like a replacement for HFS Plus would be nice because that's getting seriously old. Xcode still sucks and definitely needs to be better. And I'm hoping that happens someday. But, you know, as far as like the experience as a whole goes, like the parts that Apple provides when you buy a new Mac, you know, it's like, what more could you want? I don't know.
Well, especially now that iWork and iLife are all bundled and free.
Yeah. You get all this cool software. You know, the hardware is like, has reached perfection essentially. You know, it'd be cool if they
don't say that. Somebody's going to write you an angry tweet and like, it's not perfect because – yeah, exactly.
Don't care. They can do that all they want.
Yeah.
I'd be happy if the portables could get, you know, instead of like 12 hours of battery life, they could get like 30 days of battery life. That would be nice. Right.
Yeah.
But
graphene, you know, coming.
I'm starting to really reach here as far as improvements.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of feel the same way. And it's like, well, I can imagine sci-fi stuff.
Yeah.
But in terms of steps to take –
right.
And goals to reach. So I agree with Syracuse that the HFS is a problem. In theory, I don't know if it's practically the problem that he's so concerned about. I feel the same way about Objective-C and that it's kind of screwed up, but it's working pretty well and it's moving along and
yeah.
could be worse.
I think there's a difference there in that Objective-C, it's like it sucks from a sort of theoretical point of view, but from a practical standpoint, really good. You know, just the fact that it gives you these nice object-oriented features in C, you know, that's actually a sweet spot in the real
world. You can actually just write inline assembler and it's just fine. It's
not HFS Plus is like, I don't think there's anything actually good about it. It's, you know, it's good enough. It does the job, but I don't think it's like a local maximum the way Objective-C is.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. I think that's interesting.
Like Objective-C, like in theory is worse than, I don't know, say C#, for example, even though in practice, maybe it fits better, but I don't think there's any way that HFS Plus is better than ZFS.
No, not even close. So, yeah. Even NTFS is better than HFS Plus. Yeah.
Right.
It's just the pain of breaking what they have now that seems to control them. Yeah.
Well, it's,
You know, even then, if they just made it optional and like started shipping new Macs with whatever new file system on the internal drives, nobody would even notice.
Yeah, that's what we actually talked about with that with Syracuse and you know, Ryan. He used to be a EPM on OS X.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So he had some.
It was all his
insight
fault.
That he couldn't directly share.
Right.
He could make some noises, you know. Yeah. No, I agree. I feel pretty positive with stuff, and I can't. Maybe I'm getting old, and I can't be like, yeah, we need this like next future version. But whatever. We'll see. In the meantime, everybody go and buy 3 copies of VoodooPad.
Gift it. Gift it to your friends.
That's right. All of your friends.
Friends don't let friends not use VoodooPad.
gift it to people you don't like, just because, you know.
Maybe they'll become a better person.
You like. They'll have to re-gift it, exactly. And then so on.
It'll make them better.
Yeah. Right.
Thanks a lot, Mike. I guess we'll cut it here around.
Oh, wait. Yeah. Mike, where can we find you on the interwebs?
MikeAsh.com. It's so easy, you can't possibly forget it.
Get on Twitter?
Mike Ash.
Made it too easy. Should have made it harder for people.
Nope.
Okay.
That's the way I do it. I decided a while ago to give up pseudonyms and just go with it. And I've been blessed with a very short name. So
I did the same thing, but it was for the express purpose of me never wanting to write anything I wouldn't put my name to.
Ah, that's kind of an interesting side effect, isn't it?
Yeah, I've never been an anonymous. Like, I've always signed my name. I had Kicking Bear when I started on Twitter because I was trying to use it the API. So I was just like, well, I don't want to use my name.
Right.
So I just had but I got it changed to GTE because it's close or at least short. But yeah, there's something rubs me the wrong way about people who insist on having pseudonyms. cool. Mike, thanks a lot, man.